Hey, good morning, everybody. We are in the Parshios again of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and there's a very interesting thought that the Kli Yoker explains, and indeed I had heard this thought many years ago in the name of Yaakov Kamenetsky, but I discovered that in fact the Kli Yoker that lived in the 1500s, and I think Marvin showed me that, said the same thing. And it's very, very fascinating. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu is given the mission of being the Shaliach of Hashem at the burning bush. And Moshe Rabbeinu very much doesn't want the job. And he has all sorts of excuses. I'm not worthy. They're not worthy. I don't know how to speak. I don't know how to talk. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, no, you are the person. You are the person that I'm choosing. In fact, many, many say that it's only the person who doesn't want to be a leader that is worthy of being a leader. If you want the job, then the job is not for you. Well, that's right, that's right. Our concept of leadership is the leader is always reluctant. When the leader wants it too much, then perhaps he's not acting Shem Shemayim and the like. So Moshe Rabbeinu has no choice. He finally goes. And not only does Paro not let the people go, which Moshe knew that, because after all Hashem told him, Paro is not going to let them go initially. But life becomes worse. From now on, what does Paro say? Paro basically says, you guys have too much time on your hands, that's why you're agitating for civil rights and political rights. We'll have to make you a little bit more busy so you don't have time to think of freedom and all of these other things. So from now on, you have to gather your own straw, and your quota of bricks is not going to be diminished. So imagine Moshe Rabbeinu's own heartbreak. First of all, imagine how people looked at him. Here's this guy, he comes in, he agitates, he says, you know, he's going to get us freedom from slavery. Life is even worse than it was. And Moshe Rabbeinu, tainus to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Lama Hareyasa Liyom Hazeh. Why? I asked you not to give me this job. Lama Hareyasa. Why did you do it? Why did you make it worse? Umeyaz Basi El Parei. From the time I came to Parei, Heira Liyom Hazeh. It has become worse for this people. Vatseel Litzalta Es Amecha. And you have not saved the nation. And the Parsha of Vayera goes on, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately gives Moshe Rabbeinu Musar, and he says, Chaval al di'avdin v'lo mishtakhin. That's an expression that says, alas for those who are gone and cannot be replaced. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, I made so many promises to them, and those promises were not fulfilled. I promised Avram Avinu that he would have Eretz Yisrael, and when his wife died, he didn't even have a burial ground. He had to buy a burial ground for so much shkalim. And Yitzchak Avinu's wells were filled up with harassment. And Yaakov Avinu spent years of his life in Laban's house and then 17 years in Mitzrayim. And where were my promises? But they didn't question. They had emunah. Why do you not have emunah? Again, the Kadosh Baruch Hu basically says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you have at this point in your life less emunah than Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Chaval al di'avdin below mishtakhin. So the Medrash takes this one step further. And the Medrash says the following lashon. You taina against me with the word oz. Umay oz basi el parei. Oz, right, that's introducing your taina. From the time I came to Parah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Chayecha, by your life, I swear, that with that same word that you use to taina against me, that same word shall be a celebration of your redemption, because the Shira Sayom begins with the words, Oz Yashir Moshe. The very Oz that shows your lack of faith will be the Oz that shows your redemption. But in point of fact, what is the connection? I mean, just because it's the same word, but how thematically is the Paro making things worse? How is that connected to the ultimate redemption? So the Kli Yakor, and again, I initially had seen this in Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's Sefer, the Kli Yakor makes two related points. One point is that it's always the case that right before a force is vanquished, it has a last gasp of trying to fight back. We see this metaphorically, although not scientifically, the idea that night is the darkest before the dawn. In a sense, as the light is going to overcome the darkness. Again, this is not a scientific explanation. It's more of a poetic one. But right before the light vanquishes the darkness comes back with a fight, and it becomes darker. Before a person dies. Indeed, it's a well-observed phenomenon. A person has a last bit of energy as the neshama is leaving the body. And we know that many say in Ikvasa de Mashiach, as the powers of the Umos HaOlam that try to destroy us are diminished and weakened, they come back with great ferocity. That's why people say, well, if we're approaching the Zman of Mashiach and the Umos HaOlam are supposed to be weakened, and in fact the Gra says that that is the remez of why the 70 bulls of Sukkos that represent the 70 nations of the world are brought in descending order, right, 13-12, because the power of the Umos is mismaatim v'hochim, it's going to get weaker. And yet, how could that be when we have ISIS and terrorism and massacres, Islamic fundamentalism? How could that be if anything, these powers of destruction are getting stronger and stronger in the world? Massacres in Paris just last week. But the short answer is that we believe that these are the death throes of these kochos, that right before they get destroyed, they come back with extra ferocity. That is, in fact, the ultimate idea behind the wars of Gog and Magog, which are whatever they are exactly. That is the idea of Chavlei Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach. Before there is birth, there is great pain. So on one level, the Kli Yakor says, the very fact that things are getting worse is a sign that things are getting better, because it is the darkness before the dawn. So the very Oz that you see as a sign that God has rejected you is in fact a sign that the Geula is coming. That's a more of a general thought. But then the Kli Yakor says something very specific, and this is, I saw again from Yaakov Kamenetsky, and that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a certain dilemma, although it's a dilemma of Hashem's own creation. And that is, this is hard for us to understand exactly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can never change a decree. If Hashem makes a decree, it can't be changed. Because if it would be changed, that would imply Hashem made a mistake. That would imply an imperfection in the divine will. So philosophically, if every decision Hashem makes has to be perfect, a decision in theory is unchangeable. Now that creates a problem. What if there's a gezeira that's bad for a person? Death, sickness, destruction. And a person does tshuva, a person prays, a person is zocha. But the gezeira can't be changed. So how do we understand the changing of gezeira? So there are different ways of understanding it. One is, the gezeira was on person X. When you do tshuva, you're a different person, so it's not on you. But another way of understanding it is, Hashem's gezeiras cannot be changed, but they can be redefined in a benign way. But Hashem still has to work with the gezeira. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed, for example, that you will be reduced to poverty and you will eat crumbs, so that'll be Mekuyim that on Shabbos you're going to eat the crumbs of your challah. In other words, Hashem makes the gezeiras in such a way that they'll take a different form depending on your zechus. Now, this is exactly the dilemma HaKadosh Baruch Hu faces with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hashem told Abraham, your children will be enslaved for 400 years in a land that is not theirs. But the Jews have only been in Mitzrayim 210 years. But Hashem can't let them stay for the whole 400 years. Because if they stay even another minute, they hit the 50th level of Tumah, they disappear. But Hashem can't let them disappear because He promised Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov there would be a redemption. So kavyachol, the Shechina is scratching its head. Kavyachol. And that is, I'm stuck with this 400 years, but I gotta redeem them now. So there are different answers for this. I mean, one answer is that Hashem recalibrated from the birth of Yitzchak. So you had 400 years. But another explanation that the Sfarim give is, this is one of the reasons why there was such an extraordinary population growth. Right? The Jewish people came to Mitzrayim with 70 people. And over the course of these 210 years, they grew to 600,000 men over 20. And if you add the women and the children, the normal estimate that we give is 3 million. And remember as well that the 3 million only represents 1/5 of the population, because 4/5 died. So you actually have a population at some point of 15 million people. And again, there are midrashic examples that are even more. In fact, Rav Lau, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, the father, the former Rav Rashi, who now works for his son, the present Rav Rashi, because Rav Lau is only Rav of Tel Aviv, and Rav David Lau is the Rav Rashi. But I have a feeling that this father gets a lot of nachas in that type of role reversal. But in any event, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau wrote, you may have seen this, a very, very beautiful and moving memoir of his life, starting from the concentration camps and the miracles that happened. In fact, the brother that took care of him recently was Nifter. But he tells the story late in later years that he visited Cuba, because there still is a small Jewish community in Cuba, and he came to give them chizuk. And he talked about the fact that Fidel Castro talked to him. Fidel Castro was a big schmoozer. Fidel Castro can, to this day, can give, although, well, maybe not right now, but until very, yeah, he's still alive. Yes, he's still alive. Yeah. You know, he's outlived how many U.S. presidents and whatever it is. But until recently, he was still giving these 10-hour speeches and everything else. So he was engaging Rav Lau in conversation for 4 hours. And, you know, some of it was about the Jewish community, but a lot of it was, for some reason, Castro was obsessed with the demographics of how 70 people could multiply, and he worked out the arithmetic, and he wanted to go over the figures with Rabbi Lau. Maybe he was thinking of doing something in Cuba to increase the population. But be it as it may, it was a miracle. Now, why was there such a huge population growth? So this is what some of Forshim say. The Gezerah of Hashem, 400 years, is assuming a normal population growth. So you then ask yourself, in a normal sized population over 400 years, how many man hours would be worked? How much pain, psychological and physical, would be endured? So then by making the population bigger, you can achieve the same number of hours and aggregate suffering in 200, and only Hashem could do this. Even a supercomputer could not compute this. You could somehow get the same amount of suffering in a shorter amount of time if you make the population many times larger. And therefore, this is how Hashem recalibrated his Gezerah, that, gee, I know I have to take them out after 210, so I gotta make the population so big that the Shibud of 210 is going to equal 400. But here's the problem. With all of those numbers, when Moshe Rabbeinu shows up to Paro, I'm going to make up a number here, it's only the equivalent of 396 years of slavery. Meaning, they haven't yet done 400. But I can't redeem them till they've done 400 because I have this Gezerah. So I got to make it a little worse. So the gathering of the straw pushed them over the top so that the 210 years now equaled 400 years. It had to get a little bit worse. Because if it wouldn't get a little bit worse, they couldn't be redeemed. If they couldn't be redeemed, they would have hit the 50th level of Tumah. And that's exactly what the Medrash means. The very word "us" that you think is the complaint is key to your redemption. Because otherwise the redemption would not have been possible at all. It's a very, very amazing thought. And the Musar in life, of course, is that, you know, we often have experiences that we think are negative, that we think are destructive, that we think are counterproductive to us. But in point of fact, that can actually be our hidden Yeshua in life. Now, we can mess up, because since we have Bechira, we can choose to take an experience and not learn from it and not grow from it and then it becomes a useless thing, indeed. But if we are attuned to the messages, and again, we never know, we're not Nevi'im, but if we try to ask ourselves, what does Hashem want me to respond? How does the Eibishter want me to behave? Then indeed, even the difficulties of life, one sees the redemption that Hashem shows us. As we spoke last week, that was the idea in Mitzrayim of beginning with the negative and going with the positive, is to see the redemptive potential even in the negative. And what the Medrash is teaching us is, even everything is so cheshbened out that even the incremental increase in the koshi hashibud by gathering the straw was an essential part of the redemption to be mashlim the arba meyoshana in a 210 year framework and the like. Okay. Now we do know the following. We do know, of course, everyone knows that Chazal were mesakein. One of the mitzvos that we have Pesach night, Leil Seder, is we are obligated to drink 4 cups of wine or grape juice, whatever it would be. And this is a rabbinic requirement. The Torah is not, the Torah requires matzah, maror, korban pesach, although maror b'zman hazeh drabanan, but in the time of the Beis HaMikdash at least, matzah, maror, korban pesach, and the recitation of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Torah does not require, per se, the drinking of 4 cups of wine, but it's a rabbinic requirement. And it is based, there are actually a few reasons that are given, but the most common reason, the best well-known reason, is based on the fact that after HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe Musar, why don't you have the same faith as Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses 4 lashonos of redemption. V'hotzeisi eschem, I will take you out. Take you out. V'yitzalti eschem, I will save you. V'ga'alti eschem, I will redeem you. V'lakachti eschem, li'liyam. Now, let me point out, just as a matter of halacha, that number one, women are obligated in Dalit Kosas, just as men, because they also involved in the miracle of the Exodus. Not only were they also involved, but as Chazal say, in the merit of Nashim Sitkanios, there was the redemption. So as a result, we don't apply. This is one of the many exceptions where you don't apply the rule of mitzvah saseh shizman gram. In fact, in point of fact, this is actually a rule that has more exceptions than the rule. If you make a list of the mitzvahs women are exempt from because it's time-bound, and then you make a list of exceptions to the rule, there are actually more exceptions than the rule. But be it as it may, we have this rule, and whenever you depart from the rule, you need an exception. Dalit Kosos is one of the exceptions. But I want to point out something that's interesting. There are 2 different mitzvos in Dalit Kosos. 2 different mitzvos, 2 different commandments. And men and women have both of them. Commandment number 1 is the actual drinking of the 4 cups of wine, because that celebrates freedom. But commandment number 2 is you must perform the recitation of mitzvos over a cup of wine. So Kiddush must be recited over wine. Of course, that's what you do anyway. The Haggadah must be recited over a cup of wine. Birkas HaMazon must be recited over a cup of wine, even if during the year you're not makbid on it. And Hallel must be recited over a cup of wine. The reason why I'm making this point is, let's say, if you look at a Haggadah, you will see, let's say, that right before the Manishtana, there's an instruction in the Haggadah, fill up the 2nd cup. Now, you might be wondering, why do I have to fill up the 2nd cup then? I'm not going to drink the 2nd cup until the end of the Maggid, which might be an hour, or if you have yeshiva bachrim at home, maybe 2 or 3 hours, or whatever it would be. But it's going to be a long time. So why can't I just fill up the... do I have to follow that instruction? Why can't I just fill up the cup when it's time to drink? Well, the answer is yes, follow your Haggadahs, because it is important. Because the chiyuv is not simply to drink the cup, drink the wine. The chiyuv is to recite. Just as you recite Kiddush over a cup of wine, you recite the Haggadah over a cup of wine. You recite Birkas HaMazon over a cup of wine. You recite Hallel over a cup of wine. That is why briskers, who are very machmer in all of these inyanim, the briskers actually hold the cup. During the Maggid, they will hold the cup for the entire Maggid, because it's like a Kiddush that you must recite it over wine. They even have another Chumrah that's very fascinating. That is, they say that the cup that you drink has to be the cup that you did the recitation. So if, for example, you recited the whole Maggid, and then your cup spilled, and you had to refill it, you have to recite the whole Maggid again, because, right, so be careful not to spill your wine, and the like. Although I think about, Derech Agav the Agav, nothing to do with, our shir today, a beautiful story involving Rabbi Akiva Eiger about Midos Tovos, about, that once someone was a guest at his Seder, and they knocked over a cup of wine and it spilled, so Rabbi Akiva Eiger immediately knocked over his cup and said, "Oh, the table must be crooked." He didn't want the person to be embarrassed, and the like. They have another story, again I think it's Rabbi Akiva Eiger also, about one time his Rebbetzin accidentally, or maybe it was a cooking, or whoever did the cooking, put kerosene instead of cooking oil in the cholent. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger just kept on eating and eating and eating. He said, "Oh, delicious cholent, and he like finished the whole pot. And they had never seen him like gluttonous eating. And he said, "So no one else would eat it." And even though kerosene is actually poisonous, I would not recommend a person do this. But he didn't want to embarrass the person who did the cooking, and he didn't want the guests to be harmed. And anyway, they would have probably have said right away, "It's kerosene, etc." So he was willing to even put himself in a certain measure of danger in order not to embarrass. These stories are very interesting stories. Sometimes we tell stories about Gedolim, so we focus on how brilliant they were, how much learning they had, you know, and of course they were. Rabbi Akiva Eiger is one of the great Gaonim. But we also have to remember the Midos, and it's not, it's Habah HaTalia. They would not have had their greatness in Torah had they not had the Midos that allow them to do things like this. Okay. I think I've told you before maybe my story about Rav Moshe when I was just a 9-year-old. Rav Moshe used to visit, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, and he had a relative, and once I was Zocha, when I would go to school, I would daven in Shacharis before I went to school, and I was Zocha to be in the car with him. So I sat in the car. I didn't talk to him, but, you know, I sat in the car. And one time it was raining after Shacharis, and I was going to walk to school. It didn't bother me to walk in the rain. It was 2 blocks. And he actually asked the driver to come back. He said, "I know there was a child in the car. I don't want him to walk to school." So he actually, sent the car back to take me to school. I didn't even have any thought of this. But you see, here you have the Gadol Hador. Really, he was the Gadol Hador. And all of the problems of Klal Yisrael were on his mind at all times. And he was worried about a 9-year-old child having to walk in the rain. And I have to say that when I think of the meaning of, when art school was doing the biography, I thought I would send him that story. Maybe I would have gotten it in, but I didn't get around to it. But when I think about the meaning of a gadol, that is what I think about to this very day. That, you know, to a gadol, there is no such thing as something that is something or someone that is too unimportant to be concerned about. Right? Some people think, "Oh, I only think about important things, important people." That's not the way a gadol thinks. A gadol understands everybody's important, right? So every Jew is important. So okay, that's a little bit of a digression. But be it as it may, these are the things you need to know about the 4 cups of wine. That it is both a mitzvah to drink, and it is a mitzvah to have amira alakos. In fact, I would suggest, even if, for medical reasons, according to this, a person is exempt from drinking, you might have various reasons, there would still be an inyan to have a cup in front of you as you are reciting the Haggadah and the benching, because at least you're doing one aspect of the mitzvah, even if you're not doing the other. On the other hand, okay, I don't want to get too complicated, one could argue, if it really depends if everybody's reading the Haggadah themselves or the Baal Seder is motzi. If the Baal Seder is motzi, then if he has the cup, you have fulfilled. Okay, so it would depend on those complications. Okay. Now, be it as it may, people ask a question, right? A famous question. B'chaira, you say you have 4 cups because of the 4 lashonos of Geula. There is a fifth term, Right, right after V'lokachti Eschem Liliyam, it says Ve'vesi Eschem Elo Oretz. I will bring you to Eretz Yisrael. So why don't we have a fifth cup? Because of the Pavtacha of Eretz Yisrael. So, in truth, there is actually one opinion in the Mishnah, Rabbi Tarfon, who says you have to have a fifth cup. He does say you have to have a fifth cup. But the halacha is not like Rabbi Tarfon. But there are Gaonim and Rishonim who actually say that having a fifth cup is not mandatory, but it is a proper thing to do. And among some Hasidim, not too many, but some Hasidic groups actually do have a Kos Chamishi. They split the Hallel in two. They have a fourth cup, then they have a fifth cup, and they make the afterbracha on the wine only after a fifth cup. But Lamaisa, we have to, in fact, in the Haggadah of the Maharal, which is a very popular Haggadah, the Maharal himself seems to say it's good to have a fifth cup, but the Haggadah of the Maharal is very controversial. I'm saying it's not from the Maharal, whatever, so there may be some forgeries involved there. So we don't really know 100% what the Maharal's view is on this. But okay, but be it as it may, lahalacha, we don't have a fifth cup. Why don't I have a cup? Because of a hevesi? So there are two answers that are given. The answers are a little overlapping, but they're somewhat different. Answer number one is that the Haftacha of the Hevesi is not referring to the immediate coming to Eretz Yisrael. Actually, it wasn't so immediate. It took 40 years, but what was thought at the time to be immediate, it refers to the final coming to Eretz Yisrael, Limosa Mashiach, in which there will never be a Golus or a Chorban again, and that has not been fulfilled yet. Even though, Baruch Hashem, we're here, but once again, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have Hashras HaShechina, we don't have all the Jews back in Eretz Yisrael yet, although we are approaching the 50% mark, and the like. So therefore, it is not yet Shayach, that Geula has not yet been fulfilled. And this is the source of the Ashkenazic Minhag. It's not a Sephardic Minhag, although some Sephardim have copied it, to have the Kos Shel Eliyahu. Okay. That's a, let's say, a memory from the long ago past. Okay. I remember Andy Griffith's show. Okay. Okay, anyway. So the thing is that Ashkenazim have what is called Kos Shel Eliyahu. We have Elijah's cup. Now, why do I have Elijah's cup? So people say, oh, Eliyahu Navi visits every Seder and takes a sip of wine. Now, there is a makor in Chazal. Eliyahu HaNavi visits every Seder. There is such a makor. In fact, he goes through every Brit because after Mount Har Carmel, the great miracle of the Eish coming down in the Shemayim, when the people still were over there, Avodah Zarah, he said to Hashem, these people are no good, they don't keep your Brit. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu said, as an onesh, you think they don't keep the bris. You must go to every bris because they keep it. And indeed, everyone has a Pesach Seder. You must go to the Pesach Seder because everybody has a Pesach Seder. So there is a mucker that he comes to every Seder. That's why we open up the door, Shvoch HaMascha. But I don't think there's a makor that he drinks the wine. You know, countless parents like to tell their kids, look at the wine, and when the kid goes to the bathroom or something, you know, they pour out the cup, it's a shake the table, whatever. But the real reason why it's Kos Shel Eliyahu is simply this. Eliyahu HaNavi is going to announce the coming of Mashiach. So the idea basically is, right now we don't drink this cup, but we believe that next year we're going to drink it. And we have it on the table to think about Mashiach, to think about Geula. So that's answer number one, why we don't have we don't drink a kos keneged vehevesi, because that's the Geula ha'asida. Maharal in the Haggadah, actually even in the Gevurah Hashem, which is his sefer, that this we know he wrote, gives a slightly different reason. He says that even if we posit that vehevesi refers to the generation going into Eretz Yisrael, and that did happen, if not that generation, the next generation. But he says that's not part of Geula. The four kosos are about Geula. Geula is what you're taken out of. Where you go to is Act 2. That's chapter 2, so to speak. And therefore, that's a separate celebration. But that is not nichnas into Leil Pesach. Leil Pesach is about yetzias Mitzrayim, and not where you go to, but where you're taken from. And therefore he says, Kos Chamishi would not be a logical connection to the theme of redemption. Rabbi Tarfon, on the other hand, takes the position that since the purpose of the Yitzia was to bring us to Eretz Yisrael, so we consider that to be a chelek of the Yitzia, but we paskin that Yitgeula, and Geula is Yitzia, and where we go to is already a separate thing, and that's why we don't have a kos. Okay. Now, the question becomes this. If the four Lashonos of Geula are connected Yitzias Mitzrayim, why are there four Lashonos of Geula? Yitzias Mitzrayim was one Maisa. And if you're going to look at the Makos, there was 10 Makos. I mean, you don't get four. Well, what is the Shaychus of four? And of course, everyone's pointed out over, you know, I'm sure, countless Siddurim, that four is such an important number. You have the four questions and the four sons and the four Lashonos of Geula and the four cups of wine, right? Four. Although it's interesting in the Echad Miyodea when it says, who knows four? The one thing it gives has nothing to do with Pesach. You know, we're in the Seder. It could have given you a million things. Four of the four cups of wine. And instead, we connected to the four Imahos. Okay. But whatever it is, what's the Shaychus of four in particular? So Reb Meir Simcha, the Meshech Chachma, actually says that the Jewish people as slaves faced four dangers in Mitzrayim. And Hashem therefore had to redeem us from four dangers. And that is why there are four Lashonos of Geula. Danger number one was, of course, spiritual assimilation. The Jewish people did become corrupted in Mitzrayim. Over the 210 years, they were idol worshippers, idolaters, except for Shevet Levi. The men did not practice Bris Milah, except for Shevet Levi. They were adopting, even though it's a strange thing, although in some ways, obviously being a slave meant the Egyptians were rejecting you, but nevertheless, there was cultural, spiritual assimilation of the mores of a decadent and evil and immoral society. And this permeated their personalities and their consciousnesses. That is what we mean when we say they were on the 49th level of impurity. Now remember, when we say they were on the 49th level of impurity, we are talking about the 1/5 that made it out. 4/5 had hit the 50th level. 1/5 had hit the 49th level and was sliding down fast. Right? So that's the danger of spiritual assimilation. The second danger was physical survival. Their lives were in jeopardy. Of course, we had the Gezerah that children would be thrown into the Nile. Now, granted, Moshe Rabbeinu was saved, but remember, quite a lot of, we don't have the numbers in that Gezerah, but quite a lot of babies died. But not only the Gezerah of the Nile, but there were babies that were murdered in different ways. They'd be thrown into the bricks, thrown into the mortar. And imagine taking a live baby, just throwing him into a cement mixer and the like. People were killed generally, like in the Holocaust. People die from, I mean, the Germans, of course, intentionally, brutally murdered, you know, millions of people. But in addition, many, many people died from the work itself. You die, you drop dead. You don't have food, you don't have nutrition, you're working in the hot sun. You work for 20 hours a day, you drop dead. So there was a real danger of physical risk to life. So spiritual assimilation, risk to physical life. But then he mentions two other dangers that are a little less obvious. He says, a slave has no sense of their history, where they came from. Those of you that might remember, this goes back a long time ago, the roots phenomenon. Again, it was a book, and then it became a movie. Alex Haley, that's right. So, well, we're going down memory lane. Andy Griffith, Alex Haley, all these old things. But if you remember, Alex Haley was describing the background of his family, and one of the messages that he was portraying was, that part of the degradation of slavery is people have no sense where they came from, because the yichus of some of these slaves was a royal yichus. Their grandparents were kings in Africa. But now it's like they have no past. They have no past, they have no family, they would separate husbands and wives, children from parents. It's as if you had no existence. A slave over decades, over centuries, just doesn't exist. A zero. Like I read about a Holocaust victim, somebody, a Rav was describing, that he was once giving a shiur, and an old man just came in and sat in perfect silence. He didn't seem to be moving, he just sat. He wasn't davening and whatever. He seemed to be expressionless, emotionless. And the Rav asked the person after the shiur, Shalom Aleichem, what is your name? And the person said, I don't have a name. I don't have a name. I'm nameless. And the Rav didn't really understand, what does it mean a person has no name? And the person pointed to the numbers. He was a Holocaust survivor who unfortunately did not really practice Yiddishkeit, but somehow he just wanted to walk into a shul just to have some connection at that point. And he said, since I was in the concentration camp, I have no identity. I'm just a number. A person has no sense of being connected to the past. And when you're not connected to the past, you don't know who you are. You don't know who you are, you don't know where you're going. That's the third sakana. And the fourth sakana is a lack of hope. The Ibn Ezra says a very, very fascinating insight. He said, it's a very well-known Ibn Ezra, why the Redeemer of Israel, Moshe Rabbeinu, had to be somebody who was born into a royal, not born, but who was raised in a royal home. And Moshe had a whole career. Moshe was actually a king himself, right? If you know the Medrash, this is not in the Chumash, but the Medrash tells us he was the king in Cush, etc. And the Ibn Ezra says, because it wouldn't be possible for slaves to redeem themselves. Their spirits would be crushed. They would have lost any hope. They wouldn't have thought they had the power. In fact, the Ibn Ezra says, that is why they were so terrorized at the Yam Suf. How many people were at the Yam Suf? 600,000 men. And with everyone else, 3 million people. And how many Egyptians pursuing them? 600 chariots. Now granted, a chariot can be very terrifying. But it's 600,000 against 600. Through physical force alone, they could have just jumped on them and people would have died, but they could have saved the vast majority of the population. They didn't have atom bombs then. The Ibn Ezra says, they were terror stricken because when the master comes back for the slave loses all courage, loses all faith. And therefore the Ibn Ezra says it had to be somebody who was always free, who was never enslaved, who could give people the hope, just from a human perspective, give them the hope that freedom is possible. And therefore the great, great challenge of a slave is to have hope, because as long as there's hope, you can be redeemed. Even in the physical body, it's the most amazing thing. When a person is totally convinced they're going to die, the body begins to shut down irreversibly. There is I don't want to give it total scientific credence, but there's some anecdotal evidence that's been written up in journals about voodoo. Let's say you're a superstitious person and you believe that if somebody sticks a pin in your effigy, in your model, you're going to die. They actually show people die. Now why? Not because any of this is real. It's garbage. But if you believe you're going to die, that's what happens. And they say when a person loses hope, that's what happens. That's what happens. I had a relative myself who had multiple sclerosis for many years. But her doctor, who was an older fellow, kind of the old-time doctor, didn't tell her. Now, that's against present medical ethics, but that used to be kind of the medical modality. You don't have to tell a person. So for years and years and years, she would complain about aches and pains and this and that, but she went around her business. She did everything she needed to do, always complaining that it was hard. So then she gets a young doctor. Her doctor died or whatever, retired. She gets a young doctor, and the young doctor, you know, looks at her chart and blurts out, "How long have you had multiple sclerosis?" I said, "What? Multiple sclerosis?" And from that point on, she became an invalid. Almost immediately, she became an invalid. And she, you know, lasted 10 years in a very, very debilitated. Now again, I mean, you could say, well, maybe it happens to be the disease gets worse. It does get worse. So the fact that she was okay before just means the disease progresses. But we have a lurking suspicion that kind of until she knew she was sick, the sickness didn't affect her. Once, you know, it's like those old cartoons, you remember, when the roadrunner runs off the cliff, but they don't know, he doesn't know that he's off the cliff yet. Keeps on, as soon as he knows, you know, you gotta fall. So that's because of the power of hope. The Eibishter created this amazing idea that as long as you have hope, you can survive. When you don't have hope, that's it. So the Meshech Chochma says, there were four sakanos that Am Yisrael faced. Spiritual assimilation, a threat to their physical survival, a lack of a connection of history to their past, and a lack of hope that things could ever get better. And that's why there are four lashonos of Geula, for which there needs to be four redemptions. But now, listen to what the Meshech Chochma says. This is a brilliant, brilliant twist. The Meshech Chochma says that in order to elicit redemption from Hashem, there has to be something on our part, which is called in the language of Mekubalim, Isarusa Dilatata. Isarusa Dilatata means an awakening from below. And that brings the Isarusa Dilayla, the awakening from above. Now that doesn't mean you have to meet God halfway. God is perfectly willing to meet you 3/4 of the way, or 9/10 of the way. But what do Chazal say? Chazal used a metaphor. Pischuli Pesach kechudai shel machat. Open up an entrance like the size of an eye of a needle. The eye of a needle, that's all you need. And then, ani eftach lachem kepischai shel ulam. Then I will give you the expanse of the gateways of the Beis HaMikdash that were very, very broad. But you do need, l'chala pachot, chudo shel machat, something. So what was the Hisairis? So the Meshech Chochma says the following. Now he quotes a text from the Mechilta. The Mechilta is a little different than the version you normally hear. And that is, the Zechusim the Jewish people had, he mentions, the Mechilta mentions four. The first Zechus was they didn't intermarry. Or commit adultery with Egyptian women. The second was they didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. The third is they kept their names, they kept their Jewish names. And the fourth is they spoke Lashon HaKodesh, they continued to speak the Hebrew language in its Lashon HaKodesh form. Now, I know people hear other things, they didn't change their clothing, and these are based on other Gemaras. But the Meshech Chochma wants to explain this based on the Mechilta. So in the Mechilta, the fourfold list is no intermarriage, not speaking Lashon Hara, keeping their names, and speaking Lashon HaKodesh. And what he wants to say is the following. This is his connection. He wants to say that each one of these behaviors was an antidote that protected us from one of the dangers. And because we did something mitzidenu that protected us from one of those dangers, that was the Isarusa Dilatata that enabled us to have the Geula from above. So how is that so? So he explains the following. Spiritual assimilation. Right? A person lives in a corrupt, immoral society. And it's going to affect you. It's going to drag you down. It did drag them down to the 49th level of Tumah. Even Avodah Zarah. But what protected them from going down to the 50th, at least earlier? It was the relationship of husband and wife, which when there's shalom bayis, because when you say they didn't intermarry in a positive sense, That is referring to the connection of husband and wife, in which the Shekhinah is Shira, and that creates Kedusha, and that creates goodness, and that creates a Shemira. Now again, it was only a partial Shemira. It didn't protect them from Tuma, but it protected them from hitting the 50th level, as it were. So therefore, the spiritual assimilation challenge was met by the relationship of husband and wife. Chazal say, of course, that the name for that relationship is called Kiddushin, which is holiness, sanctification. And that is what, you know, there's a cliche, but cliches are almost always true, that the holiest institution in Judaism is not the yeshiva, and not the Beis HaMedrash, and not even the Beis HaMikdash, but it's the Jewish home, because that is the Makom of Hashras HaShchina, and that is why LaHalacha, the very first institution that a kehila must provide for, is a mikvah, because it is a mikvah that enables the relationship of husband and wife to be complete. And without that, we don't do anything. We don't build a shul. If we have limited money, do we build a shul or do we build a mikvah? The halacha is you have to build create a mikvah and the like. So that is the antidote for spiritual assimilation. We then have the second danger, which is a threat to our physical lives. The antidote is not speaking Lashon Hara. Now, what do we mean when we say they didn't speak Lashon Hara? We don't mean that they were learning Chafetz Chaim, the laws of Shmiras HaLashon, and they called the hotline. Really, what it means is they didn't turn against each other by revealing negative information to the Egyptians.
Now, Moshe was threatened with that.
Yeah, Moshe was threatened. There were some... Well, that was, but that was an isolated, very fact, that was an isolated occurrence. Just as, for example, there was one incident in which an Egyptian man was with a Jewish woman, right? But that was not the norm. It was not the norm. They did not speak Lashon Hara. They were loyal. No, even in the Holocaust, unfortunately, there were some cases of Jews that turned to be informers. They were doing it because they thought they could get a little bread, they could keep their family alive. Most of them wound up dying as well. In Egypt, they were solid. They didn't turn against each other. And in fact, even Dasan Aviram, and it could be, by the way, he only said Lashon Hara on Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe they looked at Moshe as, you know, someone who didn't care because he's living in this palace. But that very person, Dasan Aviram, they were taskmasters. And when the Jewish people didn't make their quota, they would not report. They got beaten. Dasan Aviram, they got beaten. Imagine this, Dasan Aviram were a lot more righteous than we might think they were. They took the beatings. And Rav Meir Simcha says, the great thing that protects Am Yisrael from the enemies that want to destroy us physically is unity, Avas Yisrael, togetherness. See, not speaking Lashon Hara is a positive symptom. In other words, what really is at stake is the Avas Yisrael that you have, where you don't want to turn against somebody. And there's a very famous statement attributed to Benjamin Franklin at the time of the Declaration of Independence, where he said, "We must all hang together, for if not, we shall surely hang separately." And that's kind of the message that we need in this day and age. Now, the third sakana was not being connected to the past, not knowing. Here Rav Meir Simcha says, not changing your name. Because what is a Jewish name? Again, this is a little anachronistic, but he says, a name normally connects you. Yeah, a name normally connects you to the past. A Bubby, a Zaidi. I name my child an Avraham, or a Yitzchak, or a Yaakov, or a David, or an Esther, or a Sarah, or a Rivka, or a Leah. That child knows they don't come from nothing. Whether it's Avraham Avinu, or Rachel Imenu, or whether it's Tanta Rachel, you know, whatever it is, or Zaidi Avraham. It connects a child to a past. Child knows where he comes from. And therefore, the loving preservation of those names gave them a sense of yichus, of chashivas, of knowing that they come from the great Avos and Imaos HaKadoshim. And then the final idea is lack of hope, because that's the most pernicious. A slave feels after so many centuries, so many generations, things getting worse. Things will never change. But this is Lashon HaKodesh. You know, very few people speak Latin today. Even the Catholic Church no longer speaks Latin. Although it's interesting, just 2 weeks ago I met somebody who teaches Latin. I couldn't believe it, in a public high school. But anyway, okay. But Latin is essentially a dead language, even liturgically. And that is because nobody expects the Roman Empire to have a resurgence as the Roman Empire. So why speak it? You know, you can find dictionaries of Hittite, Assyrian, Amorite language. Yeah, you want to know? We can actually get a Amalek language. I don't know what Amalek language we have in particular, but you know, you can find dictionaries. These are studied in universities, but nobody speaks them. You only speak a language if there's some possibility that eventually it'll be used again. So imagine this. You're a slave, and your father was a slave, and your mother was a slave, and your grandparents were slaves. And you were born into slavery. And you're teaching your child Lashon HaKodesh. And your child asks, why am I learning this language? That's not what we talked to in Egypt. That's not how, you know, I go shopping in a store, or whatever it would be. And what's the message? We might be slaves now, but there's gonna come a time where we're going to be back in our land, where Hashem will keep His promises. We will need this language, because that will be the language in our land, in our nation. That will be the language of how we will serve Hashem. So, the reestablishment of Lashon HaKodesh is an affirmation of hope in the Geula. And I have to say, without getting into the politics of Eliezer ben Yehuda and all of the things, Eliezer ben Yehuda was not the most religious Jew who ever lived. But there is no question that bringing back Lashon HaKodesh. Now I know we can debate Hebrew Lashon HaKodesh. I know we can debate that. He didn't bring back Lashon HaKodesh. He brought back Ivrit. Okay, I don't want to get into semantics. Ivrit is certainly based on Lashon HaKodesh. And it's very close to Lashon HaKodesh, you know, with some differences. There's a great sechus in that. Because when you bring back a language that had been almost extinct as a spoken language, because it was always in Svarim, what you're doing in some way, and maybe in his case it was subconscious, but what you're doing in some way is you're reaffirming hope in the Geula Ha'asida. And therefore, you see the Meshech Chachma structure. The Meshech Chachma structure is, we need four Lashonas of Geula because we faced four dangers. But in order to be Zocha to the Geula from those dangers, we, Mitzi Deinim, had to do something to counteract it. One little story about Eliezer ben Yehuda, since I mentioned him. You know, Eliezer ben Yehuda, a lot of the Hebrew words he made up. Some people are very critical. Chashmal, for example. Some people are very critical, really for good reason, and it's surprising that, you know, Rebbe Yosher and Shlomo Zalman do use chashmal, they use the words. So, but you know, chashmal is taken, of course, from Yecheskel, the Maisa HaMerkava, and it's describing the divine radiance of light around the Kisei HaKavod. So he said, I'll use it to describe that. So there are some Rabbanim who are makbid, they do not use the Hebrew word chashmal for electricity. They'll write electric, you know, ayin, lamed. But as they say, as far as I know, the poskim, you know, all the poskim I'm aware of are not makbid in this, so it's a little strange, but okay. But the story goes that he made up a lot of words based on Gemaras and Midrashim, and he used to go to Rav Kook to ask Rav Kook what this word meant, so he could see if it would apply in a modern context. And Rav Kook, most Rabbanim didn't even talk to him; they refused to talk to him. But Rav Kook, you know, obviously Kedarko, would talk to him. And once Eliezer ben Yehuda came on Erev Shabbos, and Rav Kook told him, after they were talking about words for a while, he said, "Nu Eliezer, maybe it's time to do tshuva." And Eliezer ben Yehuda said, "Maybe the Rav is right." And that night, he died in his sleep. He died Friday night. And Kook was the only Rav to be go to the Levaya and be maspid him. And Rav Kook said, "I know that he died as a Baal Tshuva, because he said he didn't have time to do tshuva, but he died as a Baal Tshuva, and therefore, Baruch Hashem, the Rambam says, even if a person does tshuva right before his death, his tshuva is makubal by Hashem.
Just look at his name, Eliezer ben Yehuda.
Well, it's a good name, but it's a good name. His name was Eliezer Perlman was the name, but he wanted everything to be. He was a fanatic about this. He did not allow, his wife didn't know Hebrew, but he said, as soon as they came, he did not allow her to speak Russian in the house, so she had to like talk like a 1-year-old for a while. And in fact, his son says, now he didn't talk at all till he was 4, because the father wasn't around and the mother didn't know that. So one time the father came home early and he heard her talking to him in Russian. So he broke a chair. And the kid finally said, you know, in Russian, "Don't, you know, don't." He said, that was his first word. "Don't do that. Don't hurt mommy or something." You know, he says, that was his first words. But okay. So this is the Meshech Chachma's idea that Geula is the gift of Hashem. But the Geula requires a Yisorus Mitzidenu. So as I mentioned last week, these Parshios, we all experience Yitzias Mitzrayim, Zeir Anpin. Zeir Anpin means in microcosm, in miniature. That these parshios have the shefa, the influence of Yitzias Mitzrayim. If we open our hearts, if we move towards Hashem, Kechudo Shel Machat, the eye of a needle, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will open up many, many redemptive possibilities. May we be zeicha to be able to do that. There is. Yeah, thank you. I ran out of time. That's the next thing I was going to say.
I know that this was brought up.
Yeah.
But the fact that Moshe kept Ibn Hashem, why didn't you?
Right.
There was a difference. Couldn't it have been?